Morning. You know, people say, oh, you're this wilderness survival guy. You must like roughing it. No. I like smoothing it. You know, if I'm going to go out to the wilderness, I don't want to go out there and sleep on the rocks. I want to sleep on the moss. I don't want to sleep in the rain. I want to sleep in the dry, you know. And people think that I must be some kind of glutton for punishment to go out and to do this kind of thing. If you're not familiar with the concept of the show of Alone, they took 10 people. We all had wilderness survival training and that sort of thing. 10 people, they dropped us off on the north end of Vancouver Island, British Columbia. They dropped us off in late September. And the idea is that you're totally separated from all other people. You have different cameras. You have to film everything you do all by yourself. They would come out once a week to give us new batteries and pick up our footage and do a quick medical check. But you're cut off from everything. No outside contact, no provisions being supplied, no one on your site. And the idea is to stay there as long as you possibly can, living off the land and surviving it and filming it all yourself. And you can leave at any moment. You can just hit the button and tap out. And the last man standing wins $500,000. So there is an incentive to stay there as long as you possibly can. And for me, it's kind of strange that everybody, there's about 3 million people so far have seen the show worldwide. And I was asked this morning, do people recognize you? Yeah, it does happen every once in a while that someone will say, hey, you're that guy from that show, right? And I always find that I'm a guy that does stuff in the woods, you know. But because you did it on this TV show, people think you're something special at it, you know. It's kind of weird, but I lost my train of thought. Not a good idea when you got a microphone on, is it? Okay. I always find it strange when that happens that people have seen me, and this one little narrow people say, "I know you," and it's no, not really. You saw me on TV. You saw that 2 month period of my life where I was doing this show and filming 4 hours a day. And of that, they show minutes, you know, and people think that they know the full story. And for me, it's kind of difficult that I get 3 million people or so have seen me running at 120% of my capacity, and now they think that's who I am all the time, and that's not the case. In order to put that big win in context, I've got to back up a little bit and give you what that means, like Paul Harvey, the rest of the story. Well, that's what this is about this morning, is giving you the rest of the story. Like I said, I don't like to rough it. I like to smooth it. And I think everyone here naturally gravitates to that thing. I mean, if you're going down the smorgasbord, okay, we're an all-you-can-eat place, you're going to go and you're going to pick out the things that you want to eat, right? The things that you like. Not necessarily the things that are good for you, and certainly not the things you don't like to do. And life is like that. We go through our lives and we are looking for the easiest way to get through. Nobody here likes punishment. Nobody here likes pain. And we want very deeply in our lives for things to just go as planned, to have this sense that things are always getting better, that we always have a little bit more, there's always a little extra, there's always a little bit more peace, there's a little bit more. We want this idea, this feeling in our lives that things are just going to get better. And oftentimes we will enlist the aid of God. We think, well, God is in my life now, so God will take on that role, and he will fire up with his divine power. He will power that idea up, and things will get better and better and better. And there's entire churches dedicated to this idea of the prosperity gospel, that if you're a believer, you can expect that things will, you know, all the diseases will be healed, and your paycheck will just keep getting better and better. As a missionary in Brazil, I combated that idea. Well, I didn't combat that error. I told the people the truth. We talked about the truth. You know, I got to Brazil as a missionary, and I realized that the doctrinal error there was so severe in a lot of the public preaching of Christianity that if I spent every weekend correcting some doctrinal error, that's all I'd ever do. Instead, I taught people the Word of God, taught people the truth. And this idea that our lives should always be getting better and better, and we won't ever suffer, and if God really is a part of your life, that you won't experience suffering, is absolutely untrue. How many people here have ever heard someone say, God will never give you more than you can handle? Raise your hand, big and loud, raise your hand if you heard someone say that. Now, I won't ask if any of you have said that, because you know what's coming next. That's a lie. It's an absolute bold-faced lie. God will never give you more than you can handle. Well, let's back up into my story. People think, well, $1.5 million, 66 days in the wilderness, and this guy must be able to, you know, really handle life on his own, and you know, 66 days totally isolated, living off the land. Oh, this guy's, you know, the man's man kind of thing. No. No, let's back that up. You know, let's see what really happened. I started life in Pennsylvania as a kid. I got saved at age 16 at a Christian camp, and I loved the wilderness. But that happened at the same time. When I got saved and started getting into wilderness survival, happened at about the same time, 15, 16, end of my 15th year. And I was that wild child, the kid smoking weed and doing all that, you know, crazy stuff. And then I got saved and that stopped. And I graduated from a Christian school. I put myself through Christian high school my senior year. Went to Pensacola Christian College for 2.5 years. Transferred to Baptist Bible College, where I graduated with a degree in secondary education. I was planning on being a teacher. Married a girl who was a missionary kid. And the first 2 years we were married, we were in Brazil as missionaries teaching missionary kids. And for me, that was a life-changing experience. I came back and was teaching in a Christian school in 1992 to 94, and the kids would say, "Mr. Mack, you talk about Brazil so much, why don't you just go back?" You know, and these were inner city kids, these were tough kids, you know, and "Why don't you just go back, Mr. Mack?" Well, I did. 1994, we went down for the summer, and all my Portuguese came back, and it just felt like I was coming home. And 1995, we candidated with the missions organization and became received as missionaries to Brazil. So I had to change my career at this point. I became an ordained Baptist pastor, did a two and a half year pastoral internship, 2 years or so of raising support, talking in more than 80 churches to raise our support. 1999, with another kid in tow, two kids in tow, we went to Brazil as church planting missionaries. And I loved it. I loved the ministry aspect of it, working with young people. I was a youth pastor for 7 years there. I took the youth group from 12 kids to about 85. The church, when we started out, had 65 people. The youth group, when we ended, had 85. So, you know, it was explosive growth during that time. And I loved it, but I hated the city. I grew up in the country. My thing was wilderness survival, hunting, fishing, trapping, hiking, doing all that stuff. And I'm living in a city of 5.5 million people. You've heard of Finland, right? The nation of Finland has 5.5 million people. You've heard of Ireland, right? 4.8 million people in the nation of Ireland. Belo Horizonte, Brazil has 5.5 million people. It's a big place. And I couldn't handle it. And shortly after I got down there, I started going crazy. And I went out on a drive with my father-in-law. And we found this area that was, if you go in the lowland, it was jungle. Because the whole state is made out of quartz, crushed quartz, and it drains really well. So in the lowland, it was jungle. In the middle elevation, in the Cerrado, it was like desert. And then above that, there were 6,000-foot mountains. And I found an area that was 140 square kilometers of prime wilderness. It would be like discovering Yellowstone before the Parks Department got a hold of it. You know, it was like, this is my refuge, this is my place. And I started going out there. In the rainy season, if I went down, I was in rainforest. In the dry season, if I went up, I was in desert. And parking the car in the exact same spot. You know, for a wilderness survival guy, this is like, God sent me to heaven, you know? And I started going out there, and my youth group kids were you know, would see the pictures. And long story short, that developed into the Perardua Wilderness Ministry, where Perardua is Latin for through difficulty. And it is also the McIntyre family motto. And my dad said that, you know, through difficulty. Now, what my dad didn't explain is that the McIntyres create their own problems. You know, they create their own difficulties. And you got to get over this mental defect you have of Perardua. But I use that as the name of the wilderness ministry, because at that point in my life, I knew already that the deepest things I've learned about my God, I've learned in the midst of my deepest sufferings. And we don't want that to be that way, do we? We want to get a raise and know God more, right? We want, it's like the in wilderness survival, there is this total fantasy out there of, I'm on a lot of different boards and discussion groups and things like that about wilderness survival and bushcraft, and there is this persistent fantasy among people that are interested in what I do, that you're going to go out there in the wilderness and you get stranded and you're going to make a bunch of snares and all the rabbits are going to go into those snares. Right? And you're going to go out in the morning and take all these rabbits, and then you're going to make a bunch of bird traps, and then all the birds are going to run to those bird traps and get caught. And all the weather's always going to cooperate. All the things you need to make everything are going to be right there in season, all the edible plants. And they have this Garden of Eden kind of mindset that that's what wilderness is like. And then you get into real wilderness. Nobody ever, I remember when in a wilderness survival exercise getting 150 chigger bites. Seriously, it looks like Dick Cheney hit me with a shotgun. Boom, you know, I'm just like, that doesn't work into anyone's fantasy, okay? 3 o'clock in the morning and you're insane with itching. You know, the fantasy and the reality of the two things are very different. And I think with our lives, we have that same problem, that we look at our lives and we have this fantasy that, okay, this is the way I think it should go. This is the way I want things to go. And it doesn't. And we get those calls at 3 o'clock in the morning. If your phone ever rings at 3 o'clock in the morning, it's not a good thing, is it? It's like, oh my goodness, okay? And things happen. Well, for me, I remember being as a missionary in Brazil thinking, the one thing I fear the most is losing this life that that the Lord has given me. That here I am living in South America. I'm speak fluent Portuguese now, and I've got this amazing ministry with young people, and the church is growing, and things are great. And there was this amazing aspect of being a missionary that was fantastic. At the same time, there's a current running. There was some very horrific things that happened to us as a family in Brazil. And I won't go into all the gory details here, but suffice to say that any man in this room that has children would be where I was, debating whether or not to kill somebody. All right, that's how bad it was. And during the same time, during this time as missionaries in Brazil, we lost all of our coworkers. We had been planned to be a team of five couples, and one by one they all left, and we were alone on the field for the last 7 years we were there. We took a 55% pay cut because in 2008 the dollar fell apart. When we went, it was 3.5 to 1, 3.5 Brazilian reais to $1, and that dropped to 1.5. Now, think about that. What would that do to your life right now if you took a 55% pay cut? That's a tough pill to swallow. Okay, my wife had some chronic health issues. The upshoot of it is that I won't go into all the details, but it was horrific, and pastor's heard the story, and he can nod his head and say, yeah, I wouldn't. It was 2012, my personal apocalypse arrived, that my wife of 25 years decided we were getting a divorce, and that was it. I'm an ordained Baptist pastor. I don't believe in divorce. I didn't believe in divorce then. I don't believe in divorce now. But I do have to believe that I'm divorced, because that's what happened. So all of my training, all of my education, all of my life experience was to be a missionary in Brazil, and this is what I was planning on doing for the rest of my life, and retiring in Brazil as a career missionary. And all of a sudden, all of it is gone. She decided to move to, and don't be hard on her, because there was an awful lot of horrific things that were happening, and that's how she decided to handle it. Wrong decision, but that's what happened. I find myself all of a sudden living in Grand Rapids, Michigan, because my in-laws, her parents lived in Michigan, and she wanted to live near them. If I want to see my kids, I have to live in Michigan. I'm living in a single-bedroom apartment. I have a job inspecting foreclosed homes. And it was like living after the zombie apocalypse. I went from one empty house to the next. Did this big four-wheel drive, you know, just going from one empty house to the next, photographing houses. And not really talking to anyone. My boss lived in Iowa. His boss lived in Utah. The company was from Pennsylvania. And I was just one of three representatives of this company in Michigan, which was good. I needed that at the time. When you go through a divorce and the loss of a career and the loss of all your friends and the loss of your home, all those loss, it was just like everything all of a sudden was stripped away from me. Everything that I had looked to for a sense of life or purpose or meaning was just gone. And I got to see my kids at once every 2 weeks. And, you know, divorce is horrible. It is not a solution. It's an exchange of problems. You exchange one set of problems for the other. And that choice was forced on me. And just at the point in my life where I was starting to gain a sense of personal identity again based on this new life that I'm living, I'm now the divorced guy, home inspector, the company, I lost the contract with the state of Michigan. I lost my secular job. And now I got nothing. You know, and I'm thinking, Lord, when is this going to end? Everything is just falling apart. Everything's just going away. Everything's just leaving. And I get this Facebook message, you look like a good candidate for our TV show. Could you please apply? And I'm like, well, what is this? Now, I had applied for a show in Brazil. They had asked me to apply for their version of Dual Survival. And I did the screen test. It came right down to me and another guy, and they went with the other guy. And with the TV people, it's like, you're the guy, you're the guy, you're the guy. You're not the guy. You know, they just they pump you up, they keep you on the string, and then they cut you off, and now you're not it. So I figure, you know what, I'm not doing anything right now. Why not apply for the show? I'm reading through it. Anywhere in the world, up to a year in the wilderness, totally alone, filming it yourself. And at this point, it's seeming like this is perfect. I mean, I want to check out of this life anyway. You know, I don't want to be here anymore. And I look at the bottom and it says $500,000 cash prize. Yeah, I can do this. I think, uh-huh. I went right through the casting process, you know, and to make a long story short on that, I get right through the casting process. I get invited to boot camp out in New York State. They invited 20 people, 3,500 people applied for this thing. And they invited 20 of us to boot camp, and they were going to put us through our paces. And you get there, and you sign the non-disclosure agreements, and now they open up all the details of the show. You can hear everything, how it works. And the more I'm hearing this, I'm saying, Lord, if you do not want me to go on this show, do not let them offer me a slot. You know, because there's no way I'll turn this down, and you know that. So if you don't want me to do it, just pull back and let me fail. You know, when we did the field evaluation part, the first thing they had us do was make a bow drill fire. They gave us a piece of string. I could use my knife, go off and make a fire. And I was the only one that got it done in the time allotted. And they're looking now all of a sudden, all these 20 people are looking at me like, okay, this guy's a serious contender. And Mike Lowe was an Air Force SEER instructor. The Air Force Survival School, he was an instructor for them. You know, and Jose was a Spanish Foreign Legion Special Forces. Justin was an Army sniper. You know, we had instructors from major schools all around. Dr. Nicole Apelian, who does safaris in Africa and has a master's in marine biology. And there's me. Hi, I'm the missionary guy. You know, I taught kids Bible in Brazil. And I didn't feel that big. But after that first trial, you know, I'm the guy to watch. And I was the only one that actually did all the tasks in the time allotted and during the field evaluation. And I felt pretty strong coming out of that. So when I get home a couple days later, they did a Skype interview and they had offered me a slot on the show as one of these 10 contestants. And then I'm like, oh wow, this is getting real. You know, I had 3 weeks to prepare to, you know, study up on Vancouver Island, because they didn't tell us it was Vancouver Island again until boot camp. So I got a few weeks to study and get my gear in order and everything, and then all of a sudden we're on Vancouver Island and ready to do this thing. I remember thinking the night before, I couldn't take my Bible with me. And I remember opening it up and reading, and I was reading it. I got to the end of Isaiah chapter 40. And I'd memorized these verses years ago. So I'm reading through, and he says, he gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those that hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. And I wept when I read that. I started reading at the beginning of the chapter. I get down to the end of this thing, and that's what the Lord's going to share with me right before I go onto this island, right before I drop off into the bush. And I got my rain jacket out, my camo rain jacket, and I wrote the verse in the top of the hood on the inside, just to keep that here to guard my heart and my mind. And then it's the morning of, and I'm dropping off in the bush. You know, some things had happened the week before that. I had spent the last of my savings on gear for the show. We had to provide all our equipment. I was taking my guns over to my friend Gene's house, and I'm parked at a stoplight. And I got this nice Jeep, 1995 Jeep Cherokee Orvis Edition. And bam, I get hit by 45 miles an hour right in the back of that Jeep, sitting at a stoplight, totaled my Jeep. And my daughter moved into my apartment, you know, and all these things happened right before I left. My bank account was zeroed out. My Jeep is gone. My apartment now is occupied with my daughter. And I go to this island. And after 6 days on the island, I remember sitting down. It was the first time I had taken a break. You know, maybe that's biblical, you know, the 6-day, you know, 7-day you rested kind of thing. And I sit down and I just remember thinking, Lord, you have now taken everything from me. You've taken everything away. I mean, I have no food. I have a backpack. I have 10 items of gear, a backpack, a forest, and I am literally now exiled to the north end of nowhere. I'm on a rock in the middle of nowhere. Everything's gone. Everything I've ever looked to for a sense of life or purpose or meaning or identity or any of those things that I used as, you know, these are the marks of my success, one by one, everything gone. Even my Jeep. I loved my Jeep. It was a good Jeep. It was green. I like green, you know? And it's all done, all gone. I said, Lord, the only thing you have left to take away from me at this point in time is my life or my health. And you've put me, hey, among the highest concentration of cougars and black bears on the planet. And no gun. You could easily take my life or my health out here. And then I remember saying, Lord, I'm okay with that. Because this life is so much belongs to you. I'm done fighting. I'm done fighting it. I scraped and scrapped it to retain every one of those things that I had lost. Every last one of them, God took away from me, screaming in his face. The marks of my fingernails are in everything that he took away as he dragged it away from me. Folks, I've never been in any area where God has blessed my life and he hasn't dragged me kicking and screaming. I don't like change. Yeah, neither do you, if you're honest with yourself. And we have this fantasy life that God will never give you more than you can handle, and that's wrong. Remember, we read these verses today. We don't want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about the troubles experienced in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure. That's the Apostle Paul speaking there. Far beyond our ability to endure. Why did these things happen? I mean, I was a missionary. I was a Christian school teacher. You know, these are things that a lot of people say, well, if you're really spiritual, you'll have a spiritual occupation. You'll be a professional minister. You know, I was all those things. I was a pastor. I was a missionary. I was a Christian school teacher. Here I'm trying to do the right thing, and just wave after wave after wave of things are just attacking and hitting me. And on top of all the garbage which I bring to the game, I'm not perfect. There's all kinds of errors I make in this, you know, and all these things were coming down, and I find myself exiled onto this island, and I actually am a professional at wilderness survival. I do this stuff, you know, and if you're going to feed yourself in the woods, there's a two-pronged approach. You can have active fishing and hunting, which means you're walking around with a bow and arrow or a gun, and you're actively looking at something, and you're going to kill it and eat it, and it engages your brain and your weapons and your cunning and your skill to actually murder some innocent animal. The other thing is active fishing, where you're standing there with a line and a pole and you're actively engaged in the activity of fishing. Well, the passive fishing and passive hunting is creating traps and snares and all that on land, and in the water you're putting out trot lines and nets and things like this. And to get yourself fed, you have to do two with both those approaches. You have to have as much food gathering infrastructure out there as possible, and every time you can get out to hunt and fish, you actively do that, and with these two things engaged, you get to eat. And I got there. I made a whole gill net. I had a commercial gill net, and I found a dead rope. I took it all apart. I made a net needle and made rope and everything. And I actually wove myself a whole second gill net so that I could set out this infrastructure. I started making trot lines and setting set lines and things in the water, trying to catch things. And one by one, they got defeated. The logs would come in off Quatsino Sound and circulate in my cove. You know, logs would fall off the logging ships or fall into the water. And I get these cedar torpedoes. I'm stringing up a net, which is, you know, 15 yards wide, and these giant 1,000-pound logs are just drifting right through the middle of it, tearing it all down. And I took the time to actually create a whole second net. I've got a kelp forest out there in front. Bull kelp is this huge, it's like whips, these big, long ropes that float and got ribbons on the top, and when the waves would come through, they'd tear them all out. So I'm throwing lines, hooks in the water, leaving them overnight, so they're fishing while I'm sleeping. I get up in the morning, and what are they catching? Bull kelp. And these big wads of bull kelp would come churning through and pick up those hooks. I lost 7 hooks in the first 2 weeks. And my battle with the gill net became, you know, this exercise in frustration. I reset it in five different locations. And I remember coming out, it was about day 30, day 28, day 30. I come out in the morning, and the gill net, I had it set with a tripod on the beach, the big rock, and it's now stretched across to this rocky shoreline. And that had collapsed. And in the surf, rolling back and forth, it had just tied itself into a big ball. And I came out, in my normal life, I don't swear. And every guy knows here, you can be pushed hard enough that, yeah, that's going to pop out. And I was at that moment, I was that frustrated, that angry. I just wanted to throw that net through in a hole in the forest and walk away from it. And I pick it up, and what do you think's in the middle of that net? No, not a fish, I wish. It was a giant northern kelp crab, this huge thing. They got a body like this and these giant claws, and there's this huge crab in there. And I had to untangle the net. And as I'm working on this net, I'm untangling it. Now, remember, this is like a 40-day fast at this point. I had lost 25 pounds in the first 3 weeks. Okay? The first time they actually weighed me with a doctor out there, I had lost 25 pounds. Started at 195, and I was now down to, 170 pounds, and really worried that I'm just going to, another 3 weeks, I'll be like middle school weight, I can't do that. I'm not bone, stick figure. I'm working on that net, and all of a sudden, it became a metaphor for my life. Here I am trying to do the right thing, trying to do the thing that I'm supposed to be doing, and just wave after wave after wave are just destroying me and breaking me down. And people, faces started coming back, faces that of people I thought I'd forgiven. Not killing somebody is not the same as forgiving them. All right, just lay that out there. Just because you didn't murder the man doesn't mean you have forgiven him, all right? And these faces kept coming back. Organizations, people. And also my own mistakes, my own errors, a lot of self-recrimination. In the silence of that cove, it was just this emotional detox. There's nothing coming in. You're not dealing with anyone. There's no new input from planet Earth or society or your family. You're going to deal with all the garbage from your past in that kind of isolation. And as they were coming up, I confessed. I confessed all my stuff and laid it out there and received forgiveness. And as soon as I got through that work, the Lord started bringing people back to me, okay? Because he had just forgiven me for all the horrible stuff that I did, and now all the horrible stuff that other people did. And I had to feel that emotion. I had to feel those things as they came back. I had to really engage with them and then work through those things and then finally give them to the Lord. And after I cleared that net out, it was like I had this crab, and I take this crab back to my shelter and I made a big deal out of cooking it and filmed it and everything. And I'm talking about it. And I said, Lord, when I get out of here, I'm going to an all-you-can-eat crab place and I'm just eating as many crabs as I can. They're going to lose money. These things are amazing, They say the best sauce is hunger, right? And crabs are normally delicious. You pay like $26 a pound for these big crabs, and I hear I'm just eating one, and it didn't feel like surviving. It felt like God was smiling on me. A couple days later, I'm out fishing, and I'm looking in the kelp, and I'm looking through the water, and over here I see this thing just moving. I look over, and there's another one of these giant kelp crabs. He's laying on top. I'm colorblind, so it's very hard to see them when they're right side up, but when they flip over, they're light, and against the dark kelp, I see this thing moving. I'm like, yeah. I throw the limpet on him, and he grabs on it like this. We're greedy little guys. They grab on, and then they hook into the kelp, and I'm pulling, and he's pulling, and we're fighting. And I got tired of fighting him, and I let go, and he let go, and I pull him off the kelp, and he just flies up into the rocks, So I killed him. And because they're dangerous. I mean, they're like, they'll take a chunk out of you. So I kill him. String them up, and I look in there, and there's like 12 more out there in the lagoon on top of the thing. So I caught six of them that evening, and they actually used that in one of the episodes. They're like yelling and everything, and God gave me that all-you-can-eat crab feast. I go back. I had this two-quart pot completely filled with broken crabs, and just thinking how good God is that He does things like that. That His hand has been in this from the get-go. And everything that I'd been through to this point, he's brought me to this point. He's stripped me down to nothing. He even mentally, emotionally, spiritually broke me down to nothing there on the beach. But as soon as the work was done, as soon as that emotional catharsis happened, it's like he's like, all right, you're going to be out here a while, but we're going to have some fun. And it totally turned around for me. That turning point, they got it right on the show when they showed that crab feast as the turning point. And then I started fishing and learned how to actively catch fish, and I started catching more and more fish every day. I used to go fishing on this reef, and as the tide would go down, I could get across these two, you know, normally water-filled channels and get out on the reef, and then the tide would start coming back in, and I had to get back out of there before I got trapped. And so it was always this, you know, race against the tide to get into my prime fishing location. About day 40-something, I discovered how to get down the west side of my cove. And I'd always come to cliffs there during the tide, and I'd never been there at extreme low tide. So when the tide got very, very low, one day I went there, and sure enough, I could get around the cliffs and on down the coastline. I found a tide pool there, and I go up to it, and there's five of these northern kelp crabs in the tide pool. I'm like, yeah, cool. So I had another all-you-can-eat crab feast. But before I left, I took a bunch of mussels, and the mussels were poisonous, red tide poisoning. We couldn't eat them. I throw them in there, and I come back the next day. Five more crabs, all right? Because the tide comes in, they go in there, and the tide goes out. It's like a slot machine for crabs. You put in poisonous mussels, you get out sweet crabs, you know? So I started living really, really well out there. It was hard. By about day 45, I was ready for it to be done. It wasn't fun anymore. And there will come a point where all your best ideas are implemented, all the best things you know to do are in action, and you're just living the same day over and over and over again until something changes. And for me personally, I thought I was going to go out on a backboard. I'm waiting for this thing to be done. The reality of wilderness survival and the reality of life is very much different than the fantasy. That we expect things to go, we want things to go well, but and we want to even reinterpret the Word of God to say that we're going to be okay. You know, Paul says in Romans 8, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. Have you thought about that? The sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that will be revealed in us. I think we get it wrong when we think about that verse. We think that he will reveal glory to us. That's not what he's saying there. He will reveal the glory in us, where he resides, where he has taken up residence in union with us. That's the glory that he will reveal. And he does that through our sufferings. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. At the end of the chapter, we would love to rewrite Romans 8, certain portions of it. You know, verse 35, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? Verse 37, no, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. And we want that to say, from all these things, we want it to say that, you know, hunger and nakedness and sword and famine, and from all these things he will rescue you. You're not going to have to deal with that. But he doesn't say that, does he? He says, in all these things, we are more than conquerors. In persecution, in nakedness, in famine, in violence. In other words, you're going to go through it. And we have this fantasy Christianity that says, God will never give me more than I can handle. I'm never going to have to deal with anything which is beyond me. I will never have to deal with the brokenness of my personal apocalypse. I will never have to deal with death to self. Christ said, take up my what and follow me? Cross. There's all manner of ways that people can die. You know, I've never heard of anyone crucifying themselves. Have you? It's not even physically possible, really. You might get yourself partially nailed down, but you're not going to be able to finish the job. You're going to have one free hand, and that free hand is going to be used to get you out of that situation by hook or by crook. You know, that when Christ talked about death to self, he used the very form of death that he was subject to, which he didn't even apply to himself. He submitted to it, but it was done to him by another. And as we go through our lives, we build up all these things that give us purpose and meaning in life, and we establish this identity of all these external things. And for me, it was missionary, pastor, wilderness survival instructor, you know, all these different relationships and things, a homeowner. And I had all these things. And the Lord came along and kicked the entire rickety pile out from under me until I landed with nothing. You know, I've studied some martial arts, and any idiot can take somebody apart with a knife. It's a fact. It takes someone with true talent to put someone back together with a knife, right? Maybe there's a surgeon in here who's nodding his head, like, yeah, that takes a lot of study, a lot of talent. And God inflicts wounds on people. He does. But there's not a single wound that God can inflict on you that He also cannot heal. And it is a different thing. I remember my son, he had ran into a door, bang. I come home from work, and from all the way downtown in Brazil, I walk in, it's like 11:30 at night, and he goes, Daddy's home, and goes running across, hits a door, splits his forehead wide open. Oh my goodness. I got to drive the kid all the way downtown Belo to get him fixed. And I remember him laying there on the table, and they were going to, you know, sew this thing up. And I had to hold him still. I had to physically restrain Daniel while the doctor's sewing, you know, this plastic surgery stitch and closing his forehead up. And he's just begging me, stop, Daddy, make him stop. Don't let him touch me, this kind of thing. And love says no. Love says you're going to go through this thing because you need this. And there's a total difference in life between being, you know, violently attacked by a bandit in the street with a knife and being violently attacked on a table by a surgeon who's doing this with a purpose, and he's going to put you back together when you're all done, and this is what you need to heal. You can't live with that thing in you. It's got to go, and there's only one way to get it out. And for me, I had established my whole personal identity on all these external things, and God took them all away. Stripped me down to nothing. Got me to the point where I could not go on one more, out in the woods, out in the bush. I couldn't go on one more moment. I had no strength left. But I was still there. And yeah, I had that phone. I could call them and say, you know what? Pick me up. I'm leaving. But God was being faithful to me. And He had me in this test. And it wasn't up to me to say, oh, you know, I'm just going to opt out of this test. I've never been able to tap out of life's test before. What makes this one any different? And I thought, someday I'm going to get injured and there'll be the end of this thing. So God taught me just to depend on Him, moment by moment by moment. Not think about the future. You don't have a future. You've got a now. I'm flying from here to Vancouver, British Columbia. That's the plan, right? Is that going to happen? I don't know. I paid for it. I hope it happens. But if something happens in between here and there, you know, I have no guarantee I'll even get to the airport today. God's given me a right now. So I'm going to exalt Him and trust Him and depend on Him and receive from Him the grace to live this right now, moment right now. Not to dwell on the past. Take hurt from the past and bring it into a right now, which is a beautiful sunny day. Why would I do that? I'm in this beautiful sunny day right now. Am I going to go out and take anxiety from the future, a day that God never planned for me, and live all that pain and torture right now? It's insanity. Right now I can make a decision. Right now I can obey. Right now I can trust. Right now I can walk by faith. I can't walk by faith tomorrow. I can do it right now. And take that step of faith. And God's power arrives in that nanosecond of faith. How long does it take the Sea of Galilee to firm up, to hold up a human body? As long as it takes a foot to touch it, right? Peter, step out of the boat. And the faith, the power of faith arrives in that moment. And only for that moment. God is not going to pour out all the strength you need to go through your entire ordeal. Because you would say, hey, look what I did. Look at me. No, He keeps you at the edge of the abyss, where if I don't get a fish today, I'm not going to eat today. Now, at the end of this thing, I remember day 64, I go fishing. I catch this little tiny fish in the morning, and I fished the entire day. And it was like sleet coming down and hail and cold wind. It was a miserable, miserable day, and I caught nothing. I checked all my crab places, nothing. And I'm on the way home, and I'm just... My shoulder's aching. My neck is aching. I'm in a bad mood. I don't want to be there. I don't want to make a fire for this one little tiny fish. And I get to a place I call the fight chair. And it was a really good fishing spot, but not today. I'd already been skunked there earlier. I sit down. I throw my bait in the water. And I'm thinking, oh, I just want this thing to end. This is horrible. I don't want to be here. This is how I'm thinking. And all of a sudden, this very intrusive thought comes in my head. Go down, stand on that rock, and cast in the bull kelp. I'm like, what? Not my thought. I had not been thinking this. I had been thinking, I really don't want to be doing this. Go down, sit down on that rock and cast in the bull cup. I hadn't been thinking that. I'm like, I'm not getting up. I'm just not, no, come on. You don't cast in the bull cup. It's like cast into the giant ball of rope, you know, with a hook. So I put my head down. I'm serious. Go down, stand on that rock, and cast in the bull kelp. I'm like, what is going on? All right. Stand up. I go down. There's this hole in the bull kelp's washing in, and it's washing out. There's a hole in the middle of it. So I swing the bait out in there, and it washes in. Washes back out to sea, and I'm hooked in the bull kelp. Just like that. Bam. What? Really? I'm just like, now I'm going to lose a hook on top of this thing? And all of a sudden, a wave washes in like this, but the line's still going out to sea. Hard. I thought I was like stuck in a rock, and now the bull kelp's going the other way, and the line's still going. I'm like, this is a fish. I haul back on this thing, and the sea perch comes out like a dinner plate. And he comes flying out like this. Boom, he lands in the rock. I grab my pink handle prison shank. I'm killing this fish, you know, and I'm crying and laughing at the same time. I get the camera. I set it up, and I told people, this is the grace of God. This is God taking care of me. This wasn't God saying, oh, David, you've worked so hard today. You've been such a faithful man. You have such a good attitude. Here, have a fish. It was not that. It was like, dude, you are so blind to what I do for you every day. Eat a fish. Shut up. That's exactly, I mean, that's how I took it, you know. But he is good like that. There's no wound he will inflict on you that he cannot heal. You can trust him with your entire life, okay? And this is how it was for me, of this catharsis about halfway point, and then this just wonderful Huck Finn experience at the end. And it was hard, but at the end came day 66. And go ahead and roll that video there. And that helicopter landed at a cabin where I had to stay incognito for a couple days. I get off the helicopter. They say, okay, that cabin up there, you're one of those cabins, you and Eric can stay there. I walk in that cabin, and what's over top of the bed but this picture of this giant soaring eagle? You know, exactly the verse that had kept me sane and alive all that time. And I bought that picture. It's hanging over my fireplace in my apartment right now. But God was in it from the beginning, all the way through. And I don't know what you're going through right now. We could all one-up each other about the horrible things that are happening in our lives right now, right? I don't care what you're going through. Because God is there with you in the midst of it, and you are not alone in that. And if you believe you're alone in it, you're believing in the illusion, that the lie, that that's the truth, that you're in the midst of this with your God, and he has allowed this to happen in your life for a purpose. It has meaning. Your suffering will not be wasted, and God will give you the strength in this moment to deal with whatever you're dealing with. And that is the lesson that I learned out there in the bush. Okay, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. I got to go get an airplane right now. So I wish I could stay and answer questions, but I can't.